KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for tuning in today to another episode of Hearsay Culture. I'm very excited to have on a guest of a book called Innovation and the State: Political Choice and Strategies for Growth in Israel, Taiwan, and Ireland, published by Yale University Press. Professor Dan Bresnitz has written a book here, which is a very, very detailed and very thought out and quite insightful study of the growth strategies of three emerging economies, Israel, Taiwan, and Ireland. And his focus, of course, as suggested by the title, is the relationship between the growth of those economies and the governments or the states in which they grow and what that relationship is. Hearsay Culture, among its several general themes, if you will, but one area that we've explored in some detail is what I'd broadly call innovation theory, or another way to put it is taking a close look at why and how individuals and entities innovate, and what causes the incentives to innovate, and how we can harness those incentives, and so forth. And here we're taking a slightly different view of that situation. Again, as listeners of Hearsay Culture know, one of my interests personally is the relationship between intellectual property law and governments generally, and that in fact is an area in which I write and an area that I continue to focus on. And so here, with Dan's work, we're taking a different view of it, and of course taking a view from outside the United States, and looking at these three economies that have all had very interesting and fascinating growth spurts in the last several decades. And in Dan's book, he has a general theme that which we'll be discussing. The core idea what he focuses on is that emerging economies have more options, more ways to engage in economic development now than really in any time period since World War II. And that's a message of hope for anyone looking at emerging technologies and emerging economies generally, but it's also a bit of a daunting specter in terms of how those choices are made and what these economies likely are capable or willing to do in order to get that innovation going. So in our conversation, we're going to initially start at a fairly top level, as Dan's book goes into quite a bit of detail, and detail that in an hour-long radio show we can't delve as deeply as we might in a longer show. But certainly we can figure out and get an idea of where Dan is going with this thinking and some of the examples that he uses in the book. By way of very brief background, Dan is an assistant professor at the Sam Nunn School of International Affairs and the School of Public Policy at Georgia Institute of Technology. So if I've done my job properly, at the other end of the phone is Dan Bresnitz. Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for taking the time and joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Let's start off really with a little more detail. Your background and why you chose to write this book.
Well, my background is first and foremost of a social scientist, but I must say that one of the things that influenced me in the end of writing this book is that I had a small software company. I wouldn't call it a startup, but a small software company back in Israel, which I started in 93, so just before venture capital became prominent. And which I left in order to do my PhD at MIT.
And a little bit more about that background, what was the focus, and how did it perhaps lead you into going and focusing on an academic level in this area?
Well, living in Israel, or growing up in Israel in that period, a few things happened. Israel was, the best description is, a nice socialist country, or quasi-social democratic country. Rather stable until suddenly you have hyperinflation in the 70s, the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. But more or less things stayed the same until as my cohorts and my friends were finishing our army services, we suddenly felt, I don't know even how to describe this, most of like a change in the air. People like us who had some kind of technological background suddenly were approached by people we didn't even know, basically asking us if we could help them for money, of course, and jobs suddenly appeared, and there was a smell of change in the air, and the three of us basically decided to, without having any business background, decided to cut the middleman and start our own company based on what was then a new technology, Visual C++, if you even remember.
Yeah.
And what allowed us to do that is the fact that at that period of time, the only thing you needed is a few PCs, a copy of the software, and somebody like me who would go around, schlepping around looking for opportunities, which is how we started.
Hmm.
And we were quite successful, I should say, not immensely successful, but quite successful for what any one of us would have thought that we would achieve at age 24. But then I decided that I truly want to do a PhD. And I went to MIT, and in the beginning, I actually thought that it will be more in political theory, i.e., what should be the correct role of the state and the citizen with each other and with the state. But very quickly, I found out that I'm much more interested in reality and in policy, and moved into political economy.
Hmm.
And trying to think about how society can better themselves, at least economically speaking, I went back to my old hunting ground and started to think about what happened in Israel, which by that time has turned itself into the country with the second largest number of companies on Nasdaq and a huge new industry called venture capital. And people got rich on almost regular basis. We're speaking about 98, 99, 2000, which was unheard of. And the same thing happened in another place, which I truly liked, which is Ireland. And I started to think about how did it happen? Why did it happen? The other thing that struck me is how different those places were. And then along, as they say, came Taiwan, which started as an opportunity through MIT to conduct a lot of research in Taiwan. And then I was struck with a puzzle. How come those three countries, which had at best mixed history of success, basically jumped the gun and immediately become what other people will call innovator and very successful innovator in the IT industry, both hardware and software? And how come that they did it in the exact same time under a condition of highly intensified globalization? And how come they did it in such different ways? And that those different ways, meaning that their outputs and into the global industry, as well as the economic distribution outcomes of their different choices, persist over time and truly transform those societies. So my aim was to start to find an understanding of how did it happen, why did it happen, and can we create a framework to think about what can states and basically the societies behind those states can do in order to develop in what I called rapid innovation based industry.
And yeah, and we're going to talk about that acronym, which you use in the book, and focus more in more detail on what that means. But I do want to explore a little bit before we get into more of the substance of the book, your focus on Israel, Taiwan, and Ireland. I mean, what, in terms of picking those particular states, obviously, the connection to Israel seems clear, and it makes sense. And obviously, it's an economy that has done exceptionally well, as you mentioned, and, particularly in the technology sector. What about Taiwan and Ireland drew you in as comparators to the other two countries that you discuss in your book, Innovation in the State?
Well, first of all, as we discussed before, my nickname is Danny Boy, so Ireland was only that. But if you look at the things and the variables that we care about in economics or political economy, those three states are extremely similar in many of those variables. You cannot have a true experiment, if you will, in the real world, but it's almost as close as you can. They're both more or less the same land size, or land mass, I should say. Ireland, you'd be surprised to know, I think is the biggest. More or less the same size of population. All of them are new economies, or sorry, new states. All of them are in the periphery, if you will. One of my professors at MIT actually called me the guy who deals with paria states. Which I think it's incorrect, but still, they are in the periphery. And all of them have basically followed what I call the infrastructure policies that are very similar, meaning improving physical infrastructure, improving the human infrastructure, up to the level of even privatizing the telephone monopoly in more or less the same time.
I very, very quickly describe what I saw as a general thesis, but obviously I do want to ask you before we kind of take the top level approach and work our way down in terms of a thesis of the book. How would you describe it?
The thesis of a book has two components. One, which, as you say, it's hopeful. Up to a degree, I would say, and that is that societies, and again, the state for me is an embodiment of that society. It's not something which is completely not linked to that society. Can and should, I would argue, do something to better the economic welfare of its citizens, and it can do so. Second, as choices truly matter. A choice matter only if you have, if you can choose between more than one way of doing things, and that choice has real consequence. So if you have only one best practice, then choice doesn't really matter. If you can succeed in many different ways, and each way in which you succeed has a different distributional outcome, that is true choice in my worldview. Mm-hmm. So those are the two big, if you will, hopeful messages. A, you can and you should do that. And B, you have true choice. And with that, as you said, comes a complication. And that is how you should think about those choices and what are the role of the state. And very briefly, I would say that the role of the state for things that I assume are familiar to most of your listeners, but I'll briefly describe them, and that is what's called the market failure in research and development, meaning that because of certain features of R&D, especially industrial R&D, we should not expect private companies and individuals to conduct the level of R&D, which is what we should call the social optimum. And this is especially true in an emerging economy, which by definition has less of an experience with R&D, less resources, including capital. Mm-hmm. So the state should stimulate those kind of activities by lowering the risk, transferring resources, but basically trying to induce private agents to engage with R&D. And the second is, because we have a change world, and that change world means that different stages of production of each industry happens in different locations, the states also have a role in engaging the local industry with the global markets, both, you know, the markets in which you sell the buy, but also with financial markets, both inside and outside its economy. And the ways in which the state deal with those two domains, each of which can be divided into two, i.e. how you develop the skills of R&D and where do you put the impetus, the locking of R&D activities in the private sector and or in the public sector, and how do you integrate your local economy to the global market, makes a difference. And let us not forget that for American multinational, let's just use HP as an example.
Mm-hmm.
We should not expect them to immediately move and allow a local company from a small economy, which they have never heard about before, to conduct anything which would be critical mission. Not to buy anything from that company, and certainly not to move things into that area of the world. If all that they deal with is the managers of that unknown company. However, if the whole state, in a very similar way to what Singapore is doing, to what Ireland is doing, to what Taiwan used to be doing, come in as a partner, that's completely change the way in which HP or any other American multinational thinks about locating its activities and sourcing various outputs from those small companies.
You know, you raise an interesting point, Dan, that I think is worth exploring for a moment before I ask you broader questions. And certainly we've seen it here in the United States over the last couple of years, we've seen situations where, at least on the technology front, companies like Google and Yahoo and others that are in the search technology world in particular have run directly into significant political and structural differences in countries like China, where they have made choices to more or less comply with regulations in those states that do not comport, obviously, with the free press and other First Amendment type issues that we focus on in the United States. And I'm curious to get your view of that relationship in terms of, because you do focus in your book a lot on multinational corporations and their role in these emerging economies. Do you have a view of the relationship between those same large entities like Google and Yahoo, broadly putting them in the same sphere, and what those companies should be doing or how they should relate to larger states that have more developed economies and indeed, given your subtitle of political choice and strategies, have a deeper and bigger political apparatus?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so first of all, it's a very interesting question that you ask me now, because my current project, I'm in the middle, actually in the midst of writing the first draft of my next book with my co-author Michael Murphy, which is on China.
Oh, really? Okay, perfect.
Yeah, and we have indeed talked to some of those multinationals. For obvious reasons, I can't tell you which, but we've talked to some.
Fair enough.
And they have indeed had to make tough choices. From the two examples that you used, different choices were made by those two companies. And let us not forget that because this is a search engine and we, China is not a democracy, what thankfully my three countries are, this is an intensely political domain. The information that you're allowed to see is at the core of what democracy is all about. And this is where I think that we have to understand, and it's the aim of my research to understand the interconnection and the dynamic relationship between technology and society,
mm-hmm.
And not just think that either one trumps the other, but that they influence each other. In the three societies, or if you just look at economic development, the way you should think about those multinationals is actually more or less, it's both a necessity and another resource. So let's take the example of Intel, and let's look at Israel and Ireland. Intel, for many years in both Israel and Ireland, was either the most important multinationals or one of the most important multinationals. But what Intel did in both countries was very, very different. And in Ireland, it basically moved in, again, for a political reason. And the political reason was that in the beginning of the 90s, many people thought that what the EU will be about is fortressed Europe with high tariffs. Mm-hmm. Basically will be sort of in a closed, huge economy. And what Intel did, like many other American multinationals, is move some operation into Europe in order to have access. Building on those operations, Intel moved and upgraded, if you will, its operation to a full fab and then to some small R&D in the beginning of this decade. In Israel, it was the exact opposite. It started as a design center and then R&D center and only then moved to manufacturing. What it meant for the two economies is that the same multinational, more or less the same year, sometimes the same personnel, the way in the relationship that they had with the local company and with the local labor force was significantly different. And therefore, what economy gained from having this relationship with Intel was also significantly different. So from the point of view of the state that want to better its economic growth, claiming we want a relationship with multinational because you have to have them, otherwise you can't sell any IT those days, is not enough. Claiming that we need them to have some kind of activities within our national borders, that's also not enough. Because in the end, it truly matters what kind of activities do those multinationals have in your country. If they have high-level R&D, their impacts on what we'll call product innovation in your economy are significant. And if what they do in the end is just assemble plastic boxes or do even, you know, mid-level sophisticated assembly and production, it's a completely different beast, if you will, than the same multinationals opening a research lab in your country.
The book is Innovation in the State, Political Choice and Strategies for Growth in Israel, Taiwan, and Ireland. We're talking to Professor Dan Bresnitz. Dan, I want to come back to those distinctions, but I think it's important for the listeners, and because we've dug deep here, to take a step back for a moment and just talk in broad strokes about what you might view as the typical relationship. And you know, I might assume that there is no one typical, but what you'd see is the normal relationship between private industry and the state, and how that relationship might be differing in the countries that you focus on in your book.
So, first of all, I don't know if I would call those relations typical. And let's talk about those three countries and not about a country like China, which by definition has a very different views of what should be the relationship between industry and the state.
Sure.
But typically, in a modern democratic economy, capitalist economy, the view is that private industry is responsible for most of the growth, not necessarily most of the jobs, but most of the growth and dynamism it should operate more or less in what we call a market condition, i.e. you're allowed to freely buy and sell in the market, which are defined by rules. Therefore, they're not truly free, but they are always defined by regulations. And the state, what the state should do, again, up to a degree, is operate where you have either market failures or where there is strong basis to suspect that state action, without state action, you will either not achieve your goal of more rapid economic growth, or that if you do act, there's a greater chance that such good public good things will happen. Within those states, however, the political regimes which describe the actual interaction between states, industry, labor, higher education are very, very different. In all those three states that I'm talking about, for example, just higher education, basically almost all the universities, and until very recently in Israel and Ireland, all universities were public universities. And all, while there was and still is academic freedom, all professors and all employees of said universities are, in the end of the day, were civil servants, or public employees. There was no such thing as a private university. However, in Israel, for many years, the ways in which universities were seen is more similar to the way we view research universities in the U.S. They had a lot of say as to what they want to do, how they want to do, and they focused on teaching, but mostly on research. In Ireland, especially after the beginning of rapid economic development and the creation of a state agency called the IDA, a whole new set of institutions were created. Research and development and research budget were very small, and universities were seen mostly as a way with which the state supply high-skilled labor. So it was more of a supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
Also the way in which the state and employers and laborers deal with questions about wages, working conditions, and all the rest are very different. But what is, in the case of the IT industry, the most significant difference is what the state in each of those cases saw its role as a creator and promoter of the high-tech industry. And here you have major differences. Taiwan, for example, when it basically decided that the private industry, after trying a couple of times, that the private industry is not willing to engage with the development of the IT industry, opted to create public research institutions in which the state actually conducted the R&D, developed it up to the level of a prototype, and then unleashed it either as spin-off private companies or private public companies, or then diffuse it to other companies. So the state was truly the R&D agent of the whole industry. In Israel, almost the exact opposite happened. The state decided to almost to lower the funding that it gave to public research institutions to almost nothing, about 70% reduction in 1 year, and instead opted to stimulate or incentivize entrepreneurs to engage with R&D by giving them grants. Therefore, the people or the agents who decide not only who not only conducted R&D, but also decided what R&D will be conducted, was private industry. Where in Taiwan, not only that the agents were, was actually the government, but the government also decided what R&D will be conducted, which is truly significant for the development since the 70s of those two industries.
We're talking to Dan Breznitz, Professor Dan Breznitz, author of the book Innovation and the State, Political Choice and Strategies for Growth in Israel, Taiwan, and Ireland, published by Yale University Press. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture airs on KZSU-FM at Stanford University. And KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse broadcasting. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you could go to kzsu.stanford.edu, KZSU's webpage, and click on Donate to KZSU. Bear in mind, for those of you listening by podcast, that the show does initially air on KZSU, and KZSU obviously is a supporter of Hearsay Culture, so your donation to KZSU, at least indirectly, benefits Hearsay Culture as a show. Importantly, of course, I'm not asking for money for me, but for KZSU. So regardless of whether you make a donation, I do hope you continue to listen, but I do hope you make a donation nonetheless. Let's continue our discussion with Dan Breznitz, author of the book Innovation in the State, Political Choice and Strategies for Growth in Israel, Taiwan, and Ireland. So, Dan, let's drill down a little bit and focus on that core idea, that idea of emerging economies having more options than they did in the past. So you draw the line roughly at World War II. So perhaps focusing initially on that date, what's significant about that date in terms of emerging economies?
Well, let's speak very briefly about the history of industry and production. Up until World War II is significant in which, as we all know, major powers of this world have completely mobilized their societies to achieve, at least in the case of the U.S. and the Allies, achieve optimal, or I wouldn't call it optimal, but almost total mobilization of both industry, society, and labor for the war effort. And with that, by the end of World War II, the other thing that we had is the supremacy of one system of production, which is the American system of production, which was mostly symbolized or optimized by Ford. And that is what we call the mass production. But Ford, what most people do not realize, was also extremely vertically integrated. It controlled everything. It controlled rubber plantations, mines, the trains that went from those mines into the Ford factories. So in one end you had iron ore coming and rubber coming into a Ford factory. At the other end, you would have the car. So everything that you needed to do was vertically integrated and mostly done in one location. The things that globalization, that word which we like to use for many different things those days, has started to happen is that you have what people called fragmentation or modularization, or less optimistic people call it decomposition of production, which means that you can define specific stages of production and move them to be completed in some other location and then be reassembled back or moved from location to location as they move from stage to stage. So if you think about a PC, somebody in Silicon Valley might design or at least do the R&D on some components and basic features. It will then might be moved to be fully designed by a Taiwanese company, which will source the components all over Asia. It will then move the components to do, it will fabricate those components, especially the high-end one in Taiwan. It will then move them to do assembly in China, and then move it back to do final, if you're talking about Dell, to do final assembly in the U.S. and be sold. So in each location, you have companies and industries that are now specializing in a particular stage of production of both goods and services. And in order to be successful in those particular stages of production, it's not enough just to have those activities, but you need to develop a whole set of what some people will call innovational capabilities around those stages in order to give you a competitive advantage. There is a reason why most of the semiconductor fabrication has been done by Taiwan and not Taiwan in China and Korea in the last few decades, where before you had to do the design, the R&D, the development, and the fabrication in the U.S. So what you have now is a complete fragmentation of the production. As you have this fragmentation of production and specialization around specific stages, you also have different entry points. So if in the past, if you wanted to have an electronic or IT industry, you more or less needed to have mastery of almost all stages, what you need to do now is basically, or can do now, is to basically enter in a specific stage, be it R&D like Israel, where you develop new technologies which most people don't even know that are developing in Israel because they are sold to the HPs, the Ciscos, and the Microsoft of this world. Or you develop capabilities in what's called ODM, own design manufacturing, which are companies, for example, like Quanta or Foxconn, which most people don't know, but they produce, not only produce, but they also design most of the things we love to buy in this country, from the iPod and iPhone to all the laptops that we have.
So you see, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so this fragmentation allow different economies, or if you will, different companies, which in the aggregate are different industries and economies, to enter with a much narrower set of activities and capabilities.
All three countries that you mention in the book have had severe military and political threats to their existence. And, certainly the threats to Israel are quite well known. And obviously the threats to Taiwan are also well known with respect to its relationship with China. And Ireland has had its own history of, which continues, of internal turmoil. And how big a factor is that element, which seems to broadly tie these countries together, in your analysis?
I would say that this element, I wouldn't call it necessarily a military threat, but a deep feeling throughout society that the continuous existence of that society as an independent unit is questionable. Mm-hmm. Is important. It's important for two things. One, it's important because policymakers and politicians feel and strategically think about those issues, and they have to do that in order to develop any kind of coherent policy. But also what the states can do, both in terms of capabilities, but also in terms of what is legitimate in the views of society that the state should do, it is much wider. And the example that we can use here is in the U.S. Every time the state wanted to do something, including building tollways all through America, as long as it was somehow connected with security, we felt that it's quite fine that the state should do that. When the state did not have that cause in mind, people in the U.S. felt much more uncomfortable about the state taking economic incentives or industrial incentives. So those two things, one is the domains in which the state is actually allowed to operate, and what I should call the sharpening of the mind, are extremely important, especially in the case of emerging economies.
Let's drill down a little bit, because you used a phrase earlier that I think at this point we could discuss in a little more detail. So you refer to RIB industries, and perhaps you could define that, and then really to get to deeper into your core idea, what are the options ultimately that these economies have to choose from?
Okay, so again, let's go back to some basic theories about industrial development of late developers or emerging economies. Mostly the way we think about development, economic and industrial development, is almost like an organic development. Until very recently, that's how we thought about it. Like a baby or a tree. You start with a very simple thing, then you move to more complicated things, and on and on and on until finally you reach that paradise which is known as true innovation. And the model that we have thought about mainly is, in the last few decades, is Japan and South Korea as a rapid developer, late developer. And the basic assumption of this model is that the economic advantage of a backward state is that somebody else already developed both the markets and the products, as well as the technology. So what the states can do is strategically think about what industries are truly important, buy the technology elsewhere, and then move with what's called economies of scale and scope, i.e. huge factories using the latest technology developed elsewhere, to jump the gun on the developing economy. So Japan is a case in point by some authors. South Korea then developed more or less on a similar line. And that's basically the model is you first do imitation, and then as you grow and become more mature, you finally move to innovation. In the case of what I call rapid innovation-based technologies, this is impossible. And it's impossible because if technology itself is a product, by definition, A, nobody developed it before, so you just can't buy it immediately from somewhere else. You have to develop it. And the markets and products are also not well developed. So this kind of strategic mapping and then saying this is what we want to do, and we will do that by basically using economies of scale and scope, is unavailable if that's what you want to do, if what you want to do is in excel in innovation. What you need to do is to somehow come with different ways that allow you to operate and have capabilities of doing things that you think will be good, but you don't know what they are, which is what I think is a fascinating puzzle of innovation. We all think that innovation, we all know that innovation is the only way to have sustained economic growth. But by definition, we have no clue what innovation is. Because if we knew, it wasn't innovation. We didn't have to innovate.
Right.
So the role of the state in rapid innovation-based industries is to somehow develop the capabilities that allow its private industry yet to be created to innovate. And that's a completely different strategic exercise than saying, oh, we want a car industry.
The your that latter point raises a question that I want to ask you. As you know, a major focus of Hearsay Culture is intellectual property law, and I'm curious, although it's not a particular focus of your book, do you have any views on the role of intellectual property law in the development of the economies in Israel, Taiwan, and Ireland, and then more generally, what do you see as the role of intellectual property?
I'm willing to say what I think, even if it will not make me too popular in some quarters.
Fair
and
enough.
That is that it's quite obvious that the role of intellectual property rights is very different depending on your stage of development. And let's concentrate on Taiwan for a moment. It is very obvious that it truly helped Taiwan in the beginning of its industry to have a very weak IPR, which allow companies to acquire, if you will, various technologies without having to pay amount of money which they basically didn't have. However, as those countries, if you will, start to play with the big boys and start to develop their own innovation and have investment in R&D, it became crucial for Taiwan to have very strong IPR. Otherwise, you won't have big contracts with the big multinationals. Or you will never do your own R&D because it will be immediately stolen. So you will get stuck with no R&D in your economy. Which, by the way, is a question and a puzzle that China has yet to decide what its answer is going to be about.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of emerging economies, as the economy grows, it will have or it can enjoy different IPR regimes. And it should be. And if we care about development, we might as well appreciate that point and allow different economies to have slightly different IPR regimes.
The role of intellectual property, as you indicate, is one that is subject to a great amount of debate. And in fact, there's a variety of research being done on the patent system and how that encourages innovation or doesn't, and indeed in the other major spheres. In terms of the political structures of the countries that you mentioned, of course, your title, Innovation in the State, suggests that there must be a relationship between them. But of course, are you suggesting that that relationship has to be one in these situations that is very integrated, that is highly, perhaps highly interconnected? Or do you have a view that perhaps countries can develop without that kind of strong connection? Where do you see that relationship going?
Two things. One is I am not quite living in the U.S. and having to deal with the NSF and NIH. It is not clear to me whether we don't have a very strong and tight connection between the state and innovation, even in the U.S.
Fair enough.
And I'm not even talking about the DOD and its historical impact.
Yes.
Now, in the case of emerging economies and industrial development, because of those things that you have mentioned, and that's a weak institutional system, weak political system, weak regulatory system, lack of resources, capital, and anything else you want to think about, the state can and I would morally say, because I think that economic growth is a good thing, that states should have a bigger role to play. And I'm even willing to say that without the state taking upon itself to stimulate entrepreneurship, not necessarily to become the entrepreneur, which I don't think is the way to go, but to stimulate entrepreneurship. The chances of emerging economies just somehow developing under the conditions of the current international economic system are very slim.
You said something interesting there that I do want to probe, and we have unfortunately about 3 or 4 minutes left. But where is that line? I took what you said as indicating that you don't think the state should itself be getting involved in this personally, in the sense of the institution doing it. But where would that line be in your view? How involved should the state be?
So first, the one thing which we haven't talked about, which I want to stress,
yep,
is the one thing which is crucial for sustained development of emerging economy, is that the state need to know and industry need to know how to change their interactions. If in the beginning there's almost no industry, and therefore the state should be truly involved, as the industry grow and become stronger, the role of the state should change. And in cases, even in my so-called free successful cases, in cases where the state and the industry, but especially the state, didn't know how to handle that, how to become weaker, if you will, or less important, the growth of that industry stagnated. And the most ideal example between my cases is the case of a software industry in Taiwan, where I will argue that the reason behind the software industry in Taiwan being so limited in growth, if you will, is the state. The second thing is that the way in which the state, which is the most important thing, the way in which the state interacts, how deeply it gets involved, will influence the kind of capabilities private agents, entrepreneurs, companies, organizations will develop, which will have very long-term impact on the kind of things, if you will, and innovations that their industries can develop. In the case of Taiwan, Taiwan is extremely good in what I define as ODM, or what other people will define as second-generation innovation, i.e. somebody proved that the market niche is profitable, immediately you will have Taiwanese companies moving in, but not in what we in Silicon Valley are really good at, and that's what an electric engineer once described to me as putting ideas, new ideas on silicon. And that impact is a direct consequence to the fact that the Taiwanese state fully embeds itself in the R&D process and is still involved as the major R&D actor in Taiwan.
The author is Professor Dan Bresnahan. The book, Innovation and the State, Political Choice and Strategies for Growth in Israel, Taiwan, and Ireland, from Yale University Press. Dan, for those people that want to learn more about your work and your book, do you have any suggested resources?
First of all, there is, of course, a book and a series of papers which I wrote and published. I'm also, hopefully it will be published soon, a more thought piece, if you will, about what should be the role of the state in economic development is supposed to, is forthcoming in Challenge, the economic magazine, which is more accessible to people who are not experts. And, of course, there is my website, which I am the first to admit is not complete, mainly because I have a 3-week-old baby.
Congratulations again.
Thank you. And for those who would then read the book or truly have specific questions, I'll be delighted. My email is there in Georgia Tech, and they can contact me directly. And again, I might be slow in responding for the next few months.
Well, Dan, certainly having a 15-month-old myself, the fact that you not only are coherent, but able to take the time out of a busy schedule to chat with Hearsay Culture's listeners means a lot. And congratulations on the birth of your child, and thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you for having me.
The author, again, is Professor Dan Bresnitz. The book, Innovation and the State, Political Choice and Strategies for Growth in Israel, Taiwan, and Ireland. It really is a very interesting study, and there's a lot that I think, as Dan just indicated, not only for people that are immersed in this area, but broadly interested in the role of the state generally in the operations of an economy can take from it. The show continues through this quarter with a number of interesting guests coming up. Later in the quarter will be Nick Carr, the author of the book The Big Switch, as well as several other guests, including Tim Holbrook from Chicago Kent, who will be discussing patent law, as well as Alex Wright, the author of the book Glut, Ned Snow, an intellectual property and cyber law scholar from University of Arkansas, Little Rock. I am in the process of booking guests for the late summer and into the fall. So as always, I encourage your feedback and suggestions by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you can find all of previous shows as well as a schedule at hearsayculture.com. And you can also get the show through iTunes by going to the Center for Internet and Society's webpage through the podcast search engine, as well as the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School's webpage itself, where there's an RSS feed, and that's cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you so much for listening today, and please stay tuned to more programming here on KZSU-FM Stanford. Have a great day.